Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Exchange Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK small cap fund manager Abby Glennie of Aberdeen Investments. So welcome, Abby.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here because we've had a ton of big macro news over the past month. It does seem a long time ago, but on the 30th of October, we had the budget. Then we had the US presidential election and a series of central bank interest rate cuts as well over the past 2 or 3 weeks. So putting all that together, what's your sort of your outlook for equities in 2025?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things about all the events we've had lately, though, is that people hoped they would be clearing events. And actually, in many ways, I think they've brought more questions. In that way, I don't think, although the outcomes on the day weren't particularly surprising or worrying, I actually don't think it's really settled markets in the way people hoped they would. If I think ahead to 2025, my best guess at the moment is that actually it's not that dissimilar to 2024, despite the fact we don't have those, you know, big political events that we sort of knew were coming this year. And that's because I still think that we've got some really good reporting from companies, but we've also got some really challenging environments still. And the things that sort of people hoped would recover in 2024 haven't really recovered. And actually where we're sitting now, a lot of them still have sort of limited green shoots. So I actually think some of the areas that were challenging in 2024 will still be similar in 2025. And actually what's done well this year broadly, particularly for us, is things that have been resilient, reliable, you know, reported well, quality businesses, good balance sheets. I think that could be similar again next year.
One thing which might change, and this will be really interesting to hear your views, is this year we've had obviously the US market that's only gone up, not because of earnings increasing, but simply multiple expansion. So they've had a re-rating upwards, etc. UK small caps, they've got cheaper in 2024. So I hope we don't get a rerun where we're instead of looking at 7 or 8 times PE, we're looking at 5 or 6. What's your thoughts in terms of valuation? Because going forward in the small cap sector, the analysts are baking in roughly sort of like, you know, mid double digit earnings growth for next year.
I think that's the big difference. If we just talk about UK large cap and UK small cap. So you're right. UK small caps actually, it's had a slightly tougher period in the second half than the first half, but been all right. But actually, UK small cap has got more expensive than it was sort of 6 months ago, and large caps got cheaper. And that's really about the earnings growth. So, you know, if I'm looking as an investor, what am I attracted to? I'm attracted to earnings growth on very sensible valuations. And I think that's what UK small cap offers. So, but I think that's what's driving that sort of PED ratings, actually, because the growth and the growth in forecast for next year is pretty attractive.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was looking at the sort of the PEG ratios for small caps, and it's on about 0.6 or 0.7 at the moment. And it has actually got cheaper over the years. It started at about 0.8.
Yeah. And I think the thing that we've really seen this year is that stock specifics have really mattered. So while we absolutely can look at the sector as a whole and the space and look at, you know, attractive growth and attractive valuations, the disparity I feel between share price performance this year has been really broad, which is great if you're a stock picker. You know, it gives you stock picking opportunity to really drive performance. It also means that so there's a lot of things that you've really had to avoid this year owning. And, you know, I could see that being similar next year again. Yeah. And also cheap hasn't been enough. So if you're disappointed and you've been cheap, you've still gone down.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's we'll move on to some stocks which look very attractive, no doubt about it. If anybody wants to ask Abby any questions, please put them in the chat bot on the read. We've got a few coming in already. Let's start off with a company that you own, Auction Technology Group. That reported yesterday and must have put a smile on your face, because I think the shares are up like 15%. Mm-hmm. It was one of those. These guys basically are the technology partners that link thousands of auction houses to bidders around the world. So they don't actually take the prime, they just basically facilitate it. They're sort of like a bit like a curated eBay type of operation, but do for antiques and art and industrials. What's your latest on this one, and how come the shares went up when actually brokers seem to take the numbers down actually going forward?
Okay. So I think actually it's interesting if you've looked at their share price performance over the last, I don't know, 18 months or so. There's been a lot of times that when they've reported an inline statement and even just reiterated like the guidance they'd given before, it's bounced strongly off those levels. So actually I was not necessarily surprised to see shares up a lot yesterday. And I think the thing that we're seeing with, I think this stock and a number of others, is actually they're being quite heavily shorted. So, you know, I think that drives some of those share price reactions on the day. Auction Tech is one that we've absolutely stuck with, even though, you know, it has had a tougher period. And I think the thing that investors have learned, and actually I would say management have learned, is, you know, how strong a period they had in COVID, or, you know, coming out of that, because they had volume strength, but they also had asset price strength, particularly in that industrial commercial business. And when we saw the supply chain issues and things, so they sort of had this double whammy. And that's taken a while to sort of normalize. And now you're comping those more normal environments. But the thing I like about this business, so I absolutely like, you know, you're right, it's a platform business. I think it's a platform business on a pretty attractive valuation. It is now sort of back to growth, although limited growth at the moment. But I think the thing that they've done really well, actually, is the stuff that they've been able to control themselves. So they have value-add services, which has been a big driver of increasing their take rate. So like additional things like payment, shipping, these sort of services they can offer. And actually the adoption of those has been really good. So while, look, it's been a tougher environment for them on the external side of things, and if you look at what they use a lot of acronyms, but like total hammer value and things, it's been challenging. I think actually, to give them credit, you know, they've done well in the things that they can drive as a business.
And where's the growth coming from? Is it basically the added value services, geographical expansion, and potentially new verticals? Is that the sort of the expansion strategy?
Yeah, so absolutely. Take rate increase through value-add services is their big, you know, self-driven driver. But also, you know, they're taking market share. So if they can provide a good offering for these auction houses, actually, I think it's an industry where everyone benefits from it. Like, these auctions work better online. You attract more bidders. You get for the auction houses, you get a better price. For the people taking part, you know, you're not having to travel to the auction house to take part in these things. So, and they're really the key player in this space. And we have seen them do, you know, interesting bolt-on acquisitions as well. So they did an estate business, for instance. I mean, this is quite a US-driven business.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got a question coming from Ben Sharman. He's asking about Hunting, which is a oil and gas services business that sort of like has got proprietary technology in horizontal drilling, and also sort of like, I think it's tubes and stuff like this. And they've got a big position in the US shale, but also with the Kuwaiti oil companies as well. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because they did come out with a bit of a profit warning of late, but I'm guessing with Trump now promising to drill, baby, drill, that they should do pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hunting had been a really good share for us this year, and then it disappointed. So, you know, it came off sharply, having gone up a lot. I mean, the real growth part of this business at the moment is what they call OCTG, which is like your ocular tubes you talk about. And that's much more driven by the rest of the world outside, so particularly to the east. And that has been a great growth driver for them. You know, I think they're doing really well in new product development there. They're winning new work. There is a lot of activity as well to win. So you're kind of, we've been offsetting, and, you know, we knew that when we bought into this share, we were offsetting that with a tougher, Titan is their main business in the
US.
Yes,
that's it.
Business. And that has, that did disappoint. So I think, you know, things have not brightened up in that space. But you talk about valuations, you know, I think this thing's pretty attractively valued. I think it'll still do decent growth. I think the Trump outcome should be a positive for US onshore markets. So it's one we absolutely still believe in. But yeah, you're sort of, your drag that you're getting from the US business has not necessarily alleviated this year like investors had perhaps hoped.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on, say, the we've obviously got the drill, baby drill deregulation by Trump, but also in terms of his tariffs, because he's sort of like this week promised to put 25% tariffs on Canadian oil being shipped into North America, into the US, and this 4 million barrels a day that comes in from Canada. And if you suddenly put 25% on it, makes it fairly uneconomical. So it's a substitution effect, maybe, with depending on, obviously, the blend of oil.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the tariff element is something that I think we'll probably just speak about for 4 years, won't we?
Yeah.
And so, like, I think our portfolio is pretty limited in terms of impacts onto that. You know, we've thought about stocks where we think there is a specific either opportunity or risk. I work in a team which runs the European small cap and the global small cap funds. So obviously we talk about it more broadly as well. Like, we're not coming, this isn't like Trump 2.0 is probably a lot different to Trump 1.0 in terms of expectations. So, you know, we've already put in, you know, certain degrees of tariffs and things. So obviously we had the sort of what he said he's going to do. You know, let's see what actually happens would be my take on things. But I think, you know, we talk, sorry, about like there being no big macro events in 2025 like there was in 2024. You know, I think that can be, you could be a bit naive in thinking that sometimes, because actually, you know, actually was the outcome of the election the big thing, or is what happens once he's actually in power, you know, the bigger macro drivers? So that's why I think, you know, this tariff stuff will just continue in terms of conversations.
Yeah. The other side of the coin, actually, is some of the macro uncertainties could actually be resolved next year. I mean, if we do get a ceasefire in Russia and Ukraine, that will be a huge benefit for rebuilding and construction, I'm guessing.
In that region, you mean?
Yeah, the economic activity in Europe, it's going to balloon. There's no doubt about it, I'm guessing. But hey,
yeah, I mean, I think, well, actually, one thing I would say is, like, if you run UK small cap portfolios, I think your risk is generally when you think too much about macro and not enough about companies.
Right.
So, you know, while yes, the problem is you're sort of taking a bet on, is there a ceasefire or not? And actually, do we just get other, you know, political escalation that offsets that anyway? But yeah, you know, like, we think about all these sectors and the influences that either recovery or not, or geopolitical or not, can have. But what matters is really company specifics, I would say.
Yeah, okay. All right, good. Well, let's switch sectors. Let's go up tech. We go to Raspberry Pi, which came, was listed actually not long ago, probably 6 months, did really, really well. They basically make cheap sort of like computer technology, and they sell full sort of like single board computers, but also a lot of components to the computer industry. How's this one doing? Because it's one of the few really high-tech chip plays we have in the UK.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, their manufacturing is in Wales, which I've been to see. So it had a really, really good start to IPO, and then it's sort of, you know, trended sideways since then. And I think that's fine, because so what we knew about Raspberry Pi before it came to market is it basically has two sort of customer end markets. So it has the education and enthusiast market, which is where this business actually started. And then it has the industrial market, which is the, you know, really the future growth of the business. And we knew that area was soft. You know, so if you look at industrial demand broadly this year, that's no surprise. Now, we knew this when this thing was IPOing in summertime. And I actually don't think that's a bad a bad environment to come to market. You know, I'm glad they still came to market in that situation, because expectations were then, you know, sensible. They also had had an opportunity to sort of show themselves through a tough environment, because I think that's a challenge. Is sometimes if companies come to market in a great environment, you haven't seen management teams react to tougher periods. Your investors aren't as aware about the risks and the sort of headwinds these businesses could have. So they'd done a lot already. Like they'd, you know, been investing, for instance, in inventory for working capital and things like that. So things, what I would say they've done well is that they've had levers to pull to offset that. So industrial units are probably going to be a bit lackluster this year, but they're making up for that in other things. You know, in some of their new product development, their new sales they've been making. I think they've got big opportunities as well in terms of margin from using the channel more effectively directly. Yeah. So it's one which, look, I feel super excited about on a 5-10-year view. Did I think 2024 was going to be like its bumper year in terms of growth and earnings growth? No. You know, I think this is about what's to come for this business.
Yeah. Who do they compete against? Is it the likes of Infineon and people like that in Germany and... This is a couple in the States, I think, NXP or something like that.
Well, there are some sort of listed players a little bit in this space, but actually their biggest competitors tend to be Chinese copycats.
Right.
Who often name themselves after similar fruit.
well, banana. You've got lemon.
So that tends to be actually their biggest thing. So, you know, what matters to customers in terms of, you know, quality and service and be able to provide the product is really important in terms of why Raspberry Pi continue to win.
Yeah. No, I love it. It's great to have a bit of technology coming into the business, into the UK market, because we've been so devoid of it. We've had, obviously, ARM being sold long time ago. And we've had a number of other major players who have been taken out. So it's good to just refresh it, isn't it? Create a bit, you know, bit of interest.
And I mean, this is a proper UK tech business, just like ARM was. Yeah. You might sell globally, but it is, you know, UK employee base. Most of these guys came out of Broadcom. If you know it, it sort of started as a foundation support for them. But yeah, you know, like I said, Wales manufacturing, you know, who would have thought it?
Yeah. Okay, it's like Birmingham in the car industry, right? Okay, let's move sectors. Go to the shipping. We've got Clarkson, which is I think is a sort of like a broker and an expert in all things sort of like shipping, whether it's oil and energy, whether it's commodities, etc., around the world. What's your sort of latest view on this one?
Yeah. So we really like Clarkson. I think before we bought it, it took us a while to get comfortable with, is this business, you know, very cyclical or not? Because the shipping industry can be in cyclicals in parts of it. But what really has given us comfort is the dominance of Clarkson in the industry, and also the breadth of what they do and how embedded they are with all of their customers. So it really is the global leader in shipbroking. Mm. Like you say, it really is about the data and services and insights that they provide. You know, I think that's one of the real strengths that we've seen, is almost no matter what happens in the industry, they have a place to play in that. So I think the thing that people are talking about a bit at the moment is, this comes back to the Trump thing a little bit, but, you know, actually decarbonisation in shipping is a positive for them, because they are providing a lot of advice to customers and clients about how to take that forward. And we are seeing, for instance, if you look, they've got really good research about alternative fuel elements of new build ships and things like that. So, and what we also see is a pressure. So if you are now a large company, there's a lot of pressure on understanding what are your carbon emissions, for instance, from your shipping. You know, and so if you're, let's just say you're a retailer, you know, you actually are wanting to get your slots on carbon effective vehicles, because that is all going into your own carbon data. So stuff like that in terms of how they can direct clients places on ships, if that makes sense, and follow that whole pathway and journey is really important. But there's a you know, bit of chat at the moment about, is decarbonisation going to be less of a focus? You know, I think it's still a focus. They've been still doing really well. So there's always just, I think one thing we've learned is there's always disruption in the shipping industry. Something will always be happening.
Yeah.
You know, so for instance, you know, directing of ships around the Cape and things at the moment. Actually, these things Clarkson always has its place to play, and actually more advice. It's a sort of industry that a little bit, any changes, it can be good change.
Yeah. Now, you raise a really good point that I hadn't really appreciated. The amount of sort of like new regulation and sort of like, you know, change in the whole sector, it requires expertise. It's like a bit like financial services. They keep changing the rules, and therefore you need an expert to lead people through it to make sure you're not breaking, man, you're getting your right sort of footprint, whatever that is, don't you? Yeah.
And there's a huge degree of new regulations as well directly in the shipping industry that these companies involved in that will have to follow and meet by certain stages. So there's kind of the direct stuff in shipping, but then there's also, you know, if you're a retailer, you've got a lot of pressure for various reasons to be understanding your sort of carbon and shipping journey.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got another question coming in from Ben Sharma. He's asking about CVS Group, the veterinary practices business that I know when we chatted last time about a year ago, I think it was trading at 15 times. And actually, it's now at about 8 times PE. I looked at the last one, which is just frankly incredible because it used to be a real darling. Mm. What's your sort of your latest here? It's obviously got an overhang from the competition and mergers commission, hasn't it?
Yeah, so that's the biggest problem at the moment is the market does not want to touch anything that has CMA reviews or FCA reviews. And the problem is these things take so long. So, you know, we've known about the CMA review in the vet industry for a long time. We've obviously spoken to CVS about it a lot. But realistically, the timeline to get any resolution on these things is quite elongated. I think the thing that worried me about CVS a little bit in that period was actually that we were talking to them about, well, what difference is this making to you on the ground? And, you know, it did feel like actually the confidence that vets had to just go about their day job, you know, they were more conscious, I think, about making sure that they were very clearly offering, you know, clear choice to consumers, explaining everything, you know, sensible offerings in terms of price dynamics and everything. So I think it just, they actually did a lot more sort of self-training with the vets internally in terms of just supporting them to give them the confidence to do what they'd always done, which is offer, you know, clear actual provisions and great service, not just for, don't forget their customer is an animal often, you know, it's the human who is paying, but the person who really matters here is actually the animal. And I think what we've seen since then, though, is that we've seen UK stuff looks more supportive again. There's been a bit of chat as well about, you know, consumer spend. And so were consumers putting off some of the optional elements for animals? I think the real strength of the story at the moment, though, is a pretty solid UK business. I think the impact from the outcome of the CMA review will be pretty limited.
Yes.
And at the same time, you've got a really great growing Australian business. So that business has been trading well. It's an area they feel really confident about consolidating. So we've seen more acquisitions from them on that space as well now. But until the CMA review is sort of finalised, I think that's just, you know, a clear overhang.
Yeah. What's quite interesting, actually, certainly over the last 2 weeks, the CMA has come under a lot of criticism itself of being overly zealous. So on that basis, you might find that actually goes back to where it should be in terms of normal level of sort of regulation and appropriate. And I think you're right, actually, in terms of, you know, there's bound to be some changes because they can't not change something. But I don't think, I mean, a business like, you know, CVS, et cetera, you could see a huge re-rating next year when they finally hopefully clear the have a clearance event.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's limited to do. I think it hasn't been an environment, therefore you've wanted to really push pricing in. CVS only ever really pushed pricing though in line with inflation. We just had gone through a period where inflation was very high and you know, all industries had pushed pricing. You know, I think in terms of the branding stuff and things, that, you know, the outcomes of that, it's nothing that worries CVS.
Yeah.
But I mean, the whole review space, it is a question that Amanda and I are asking sort of every company at the moment is, you know, what could the CMA look for in your industry? What could the FCA look for in your industry? So it's troubling.
Yeah. But one of the Labour manifesto, one of the policies was to burn a whole bunch of red tape and regulation. But anyway, well, let's a promise that they hopefully will keep. But let's wait and see. I did see, actually, I mean, the margins, the EBIT margins for CVS Group, you know, given they're reasonably capital heavy, it's only sort of mid-teens. It's only 15%. It isn't exactly hugely sort of like, predatory, to say the least.
No, I think that's completely right. And yeah, that was clear from the beginning. I think actually the pricing thing seemed to be the biggest headline to start. Like I said, you know, it was a period I could have picked any industry and everyone's pricing had gone up just to cover inflation. You know, these guys are not making astronomical margins. You'll probably find very few vets who think they're overpaid for what they do. I think it's about clarity. Like, this is not a, as much as they can have elements of standard price lists for basic stuff, the challenge of the veterinary industry is that it's a diagnostic analysis element to it. So, and often it's in times of, there's a time element to it. You have an unwell animal that you need to sort of diagnose and treat. Yes. So, you can itemize bills as much as you want, but I think, you know, having a good value for money offering overall is important. I think they've always had that.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And also, if you've got sort of maximum fear, maximum uncertainty in the price at sort of just over £8 a share, then actually, you know, you don't need it, you know, just less bad, you know, data coming out, then you can see a major, it smells opportunity to me anyway, but let's wait and see. A lot of bad news already priced in.
Yeah, and you do see that with people, though. I mean, I guess the thing we knew with the CMA review is that it had quite a long time horizon. So what you do see with some investors is they just say, like, I know this is going to be an overhang for 18 months, let's say. I'll step, you know, I don't think it's going to shoot up until that's reviewed. So I'll move away, I'll put my capital elsewhere, and then I'll come back to it. And we might sometimes do that, but I think in this case, we felt like actually the shares had taken a lot, you know, at the very beginning of this. So actually it was one to sort of stick with throughout.
Yeah. We've got a follow-up question on that one. RP Invest asking about, I don't know if you own pets at home at all, more of a retailer. No.
I've owned it before. I mean, it had disappointing results yesterday.
Yeah.
I don't know what the question is about, sorry, but.
I mean, it was just, any thoughts on it?
Okay. So I don't own it. So, but I would say, I mean, what I read yesterday was really around the retail element. So there's definitely stuff creeping through in terms of tougher consumer spending. And I think that's what they've really felt.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's switch back to oil and gas. We've got Ben on Ashtead Technologies, which again was a bit of a darling about three or four, probably about sort of like a year ago. It's made some big acquisitions of a winches business and also another business just recently. And I think it's diversifying away from its sort of like core, which was oil and gas submarine in the North Sea. So how do you view it now, even though the shares actually have performed quite poorly of late?
Yeah, I mean, I think their shares have suffered way more than their operations. So it's one I'm super positive about. You know, I think this is a great business. They haven't necessarily, it's not so much diversifying in that a lot of their equipment is fully fungible. So it's something like 85% of their equipment is fully fungible. Because actually, the undersea work you do is broadly similar whether you're doing oil and gas or offshore renewables. So that's the opportunity for them, is that they hadn't really tried to sell into that renewable space, but they've got all the equipment there. And often actually they've got the relationships, because you find in the supply chain, it's often the same customers that are doing it. So it's actually a pretty global business. I mean, it's headquartered in Aberdeen. Obviously they've got a lot of people and operations in the North Sea. In Aberdeen, I guess, on shore. But their stuff really goes all around the world. I mean, so these guys are very much in the supply chain of all these big underwater services companies. And one of the keys is that those sort of companies don't really want to own and manage their own equipment base now. And actually, the lead time on new equipment is so long that, you know, Ashtead Tech are spending CapEx on increasing their fleet base. But, you know, that takes time. They can't order something and get it tomorrow. And similarly, no one else can. So I think this is a really interesting investment case still. I mean, they haven't disappointed. So they just haven't had upgrades, has been the key. They haven't had organic upgrades. They have had upgrades from doing more acquisitions. And I think acquisitions will continue for this. This is a real... It's their bread and butter. And I was actually doing these bolt-ons. You know, everyone in the business totally understands how to integrate these businesses. It's a good capacity growth angle, brings them new products, new services, new type, and also new people and skills. So yeah, I feel very comfortable about this one. We talked about pricing, didn't we, earlier in another interview. I mean, pricing had been a big benefit for them last year. So that had probably helped that organic growth rate be, you know, quite high in that period. I think pricing is still positive, but it's not where it was. And I could say that for all sorts of companies. But yeah, we really like this one. And, you know, I think its valuation is still pretty attractive.
Yeah, no, I mean, it seems to be trading on, 12 times PE. Yeah. I think the shares are largely just been a reflection of oil and gas services businesses around the world have sold off, haven't they, on the crude price. It's just his sentiment as much as anything, rather than performance.
Whereas, I mean, these guys are pretty well utilized in terms of equipment being out on hire. They've got good relationships, good model. Like I said, they'll do organic growth, but they'll also do bolt-on acquisitions. One thing that might have hurt them a bit is just being AIM.
Yes.
So we've seen that across a number of AIM businesses.
Yeah. But the SLB and Halliburton and Baker Hughes have all been sold off as well, but maybe not the same amount. Okay, good. Let's move to another sector. We've got a recent listing, actually, Applied Nutrition, which does sort of like protein shakes and sort of bodybuilding formulas and sort of like pre-workout sort of like stuff, mainly actually surprising to the B2B sector. So it doesn't have too much of its own brand. It sells to people who have brands. Anyway, it came list. What sort of attracted you to this one?
Yeah. So it does have all its own brands, though, in terms of...
Oh, does it?
Yeah. So all of their products will be their own brands, so either Pride Nutrition or ABE is their other brand.
Oh, okay.
But what's different is that, they are more of a B2B model in terms of, that they will sell through, you know, your big retailers and things rather than... You can absolutely go onto their website and purchase yourself, but their main target isn't direct to consumer. It's actually selling through the sort of retail.
Gotcha. Right.
This one's really interesting, actually. Why do we like it? We were very, very impressed with the management team. So this is a business which has been started up from scratch, based up in Liverpool, and their degree of execution and growth they have made in recent years has been outstanding. So I think one thing you absolutely take a bet on in this industry is their ability to keep executing. Mm. Because look, they very much believe their products are differentiated in terms of formulation, in terms of actual like protein content, for instance, within the protein, all these things. So they think their products are sort of best in class. That's always something that as an investor is quite hard to really judge. Although Amanda and I have tried quite a few of their products and enjoyed them.
I won't have an arm wrestle with you then, Abby.
you look at their global growth that they've achieved and the listings that they've got. They've hired a really top quality person in the US as well to drive that business. And they take a slightly different approach to some of, because their biggest competitors are probably things like MyProtein, within Glambia, the Optimum Nutrition, people like Bulk. And a lot of those businesses are more B2C.
Yeah.
But also they take different views. Like some of these companies just throw money at marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, they've taken a very different approach in terms of they do spend on marketing. They've got a few people they work with closely who they brand the some of the products with. So for instance, Paddy the Baddy, if anyone
Paddy the Baddy, brilliant. Yeah. I love it.
is one of their key people, which really seems to work. They've got Colleen Rooney as well. So I saw that she was in the latest celebrity. So hopefully that brings a bit of attention. They do a lot in terms of they spend marketing money actually on samples. So they go to these big events and expos, and these things are huge. And actually they give out samples, you know, people enjoy it, and that's where your resale happens. Yeah. It's a really, really interesting business. But once again, it's sort of one which I think with IPOs at the moment, you really need to prove yourself. But this management team are so impressive.
Yeah, no, a good quality one, Raspberry Pi and Applied Nutrition is pretty good. On the Applied Nutrition, would they, I don't know the ins and outs of this sort of thing, but we're obviously with the craze on GLP-1 drugs, one of the side effects apparently is that people lose muscle mass and strength. And so if they want to actually counteract the side effect of that, they're going to have protein shakes.
It is completely true. So I think people read a lot of these GLP-1 things as positives or negatives for companies. Yeah. You know, I think that's exactly right. So if you aren't going to take one of these GLP-1 products, you have to be so much more careful about what you do consume in your body.
Yes.
And importantly, these supplements and nutrients become really important. But what we're kind of lacking, I would say, I see, is the education of that. Mm. So it's something, I think it's an opportunity for them, actually. And I think they're very aware of that as an opportunity. Yeah. This is also a business which has some pretty heavyweight board members. So Andy Bell is, is chair. Peter Cowgill's involved in it. They got some really good backing at the IPO in terms of cornerstoning from some pretty entrepreneurial and impressive people. So I think there's a lot of people supporting these guys to succeed.
Yeah, good. Well, it's nice to have a big name in protein, no doubt about it. Okay, good. Let's move to one which has been in the news again. It's Volex, which is a buy and build sort of like electronic sort of like parts and cables. Provider into sort of like quite high value areas like EVs and data centers and healthcare MRIs and stuff like that. It's run by Nat Rothschild, who's done a really good job over the years. And he's just launched, or he made a sort of like a tentative offer to buy TT Electronics. Of like, how are you viewing Volex? It is actually a bit of a darling for a lot of retail investors who do like it as well.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, so Volex, we've probably owned for about a year now. I think the thing I've really liked about Volex is, you're right, the stuff they do is specialist, really high quality specialist, you know, decent margin. So they're sort of a 9-10% margin business. They're investing a lot in terms of new product development as well. So the thing they've shown through the year, I would say, is that they can do well even if their end markets aren't necessarily. Mm. So, for instance, EV feels like it's been a horrible place to be. Actually, all of autos feels like it's been a horrible place to be this year. They've been doing really well in EVs. Tesla is their main customer in there. They also got lots of introductions, and I'm sure they're sort of trying to win some of the bigger, or not necessarily bigger, but other big OEMs in that space. Things like the data centers, you know, they're in there with they were early to market with a next gen product. You know, that's got them a good entry point. So that's a great part of the business for growth at the moment. But the business is also diversified. So it's one of those businesses that I think rarely will we see every division shooting the lights out, you know, but that balances off. And I like that. I like the sustainability it provides. The TT thing. Yeah. And I'm not sure what all I'm allowed to say about the TT approach, but TT is not a business that I've ever owned. So, and it's changed a lot over the years as well. I think the thing I've got a lot of comfort with is the fit that TT would have with Rolex. And actually, a lot of the senior people within Rolex have previously been involved in TT.
Right. What's the synergies between the two?
Well, essentially, I mean, there's a lot of customers, I think, that TT have that Rolex would love to do. And TT is probably like Rolex was 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. It doesn't have bad products. It's got a really great customer list, but its execution has been poor. And so I think there's a real turnaround story that you could do under a sort of better structure. I also think that Rolex management and boards will be very price disciplined about what they want to pay for this. So, and they don't seem to be the only person interested.
Yeah. Yeah, a bit of Rothschild's magic, I guess, will be sprinkled on that potential if it happens. Okay, another one. Actually, we spoke about, I don't know, 12, 18 months ago, Hilton Foods, which was going through a bit of a turnaround, and you said it had sort of like green shoots, and it seems to have done pretty well, actually. It's sort of like it does does meats and pork and beef and chicken and seafood and stuff for the big multiples in the supermarket, but around the world, actually, more than just in the UK. It's got Tesco's, but I think it's also winning things like Woolworths in Australia and Walmart, I think, is in the States and stuff like that. How do you view this one? It seems to have done a pretty good job, actually, of late.
Yeah, so it's had a really good year. I mean, I think there's been a couple of things. I think there's been one, proving themselves after. So they had a more challenging time in seafood in the inflationary period. And that was the newer part of their business, which had been acquired in. So just having a price mechanism to pass on all that inflation had sort of tripped them up, let's say. So I think this year they've absolutely proved that they've been able to execute on that, and that business is now in really good footing.
Yeah.
Also, it's just the rest of the growth that, you know, they consistently provide year after year. So you're right. I mean, this has, if you think about the addressable market for this business, you know, the global food industry is pretty big.
And competitive.
It is competitive, yeah. But I think actually, you know, they show a lot of strong return on investment and So I think that's what, you know, helps attract customers. And also they've got some really great reference environments now. So you mentioned Woolworths in Australia, which is very different to the Woolworths we knew in the UK. Yeah. You know, that's a great, it's a great reference client and facility for them, for other customers. So they want an interesting business in Singapore, which has broader Asian influence. And then so they won Walmart in Canada. So that's your kind of starter, and it is a separate business to Walmart US. So let's not get too excited that they sort of win all of the US as well. Yeah. But you know, and once again, new product development. I can't think how often I've said that already today, but new product development matters. So that's something they really continue to do. So this has had quite a lot of management change over recent years, actually. And I think they're performing really well.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And the thing that the chart just shows you that, you know, if you buy at the right time, you could almost double your money over 18 months, 2 years on a stock that, frankly, is very sort of like, you know, correlated just to sort of like, you know, GDP and growth and people's diet.
Yeah, it should be. I mean, I think it'll do a bit better than that just because it can really win new customers.
Yeah.
So it's investment and innovation can drive it to outperform GDP, let's say, in terms of growth. But exactly that, it's I have a load of these companies which I would say I put in that resilient, reliable, almost like compounders, to be honest.
Yeah.
Now. But you're right. Actually, you can either hold them through the long term and you get a pretty good return out of them. But often, you know, if they have a hiccup and you really believe in them, you know, shareholders can generate a pretty attractive return by giving them longer term confidence, let's say, when they have a tougher time.
Yeah, we just brilliant segued into the next one. We've got Treat, which basically does flavors and fragrances, which has been a serial sort of like, you know, compounder over multiple years, but has gone through a few trials and tribulations over the past 18 months. Now, the chart looks a bit like Hilton Food did sort of like 18 months ago to you. Anyway, what's your sort of view of Treat? Because they've got a new CEO, haven't they?
Yeah.
Just recently, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, let's hope we're sitting here in 18 months and it's done what Hilton's done then. I think, look, this is a business which has really, like you said, you know, it had a great growth period and it had invested a lot. So they've got a big new facility down in sort of Norfolk.
Yes,
but
that's right.
I think the things that challenged them, a lot of the things that challenged them in the past 18 months have been external. You know, so like destocking was a big headwind for their industry. But what we saw is the CFO Ryan came in. How long has he been there? Might have been there for 18 months, maybe a couple of years. And he's been excellent, like really has transformed this. And I think probably in hindsight, there was, you know, some financial discipline that was probably lacking that should have been there before. But Ryan's absolutely got his hands around this business and really improved a lot of the sort of financial and operational elements of the business. So I think now you've got a really strong, leaner but really well invested platform and operations to drive growth from, and importantly, we're sort of getting through that destocking cycle. So the environment looks a bit better for them overall. I think the new CEO, I met him recently, and I think one of the things that I found quite interesting is his future growth opportunities that he thinks are perhaps also outside the traditional beverage industry, which is all they've really focused on before. So, you know, these guys absolutely have skills and technology that could be applicable to different end markets in terms of that flavor and fragrancing space. And they've got their capacity, so that's important. You know, you've now got this facility, now you've really got to drive utilization there.
Yeah. What sort of like new products then? Because are we talking perfumes? Are we talking aerosols? We're talking,
I think you could be talking any of the above. You know, I think it's that sort of, they've only really focused on the beverage space. So yeah, the whole flavors and fragrancing touches loads of different industries when you really start to think about it.
Yeah. Good. Okay, good. Well, let's move on to another one, which was a darling, but it came out with a bit of a profit warning. Next 15, which is a sort of like a whole, it's a group of marketing agencies and advertising agencies that help customers sort of reach their customers, more in sync. But they had a bit of a profit warning. One of their divisions, I think it's Mac 49, which they bought a few years ago, lost a large Middle Eastern contract, which according to the Times was the Saudi Arabian, one of those guys who were building the wall. But out there. But anyway, they lost it. And it was an 80 million hit in terms of revenue in future years. How are you seeing next 15 now?
Yeah. So it's absolutely been our, you know, it's been our company with the sort of most negative share price on owning in this period, which is really disappointing. And I think the thing that sort of surprised people is that it kind of came out of nowhere in terms of the dominance in there of having lost that big contract, which they thought was going really well. All the feedback they had on it was really positive, and it literally feels like the sort of rug got pulled from out of them. There's a couple of things, I guess. So the media industry has been tough. And we've seen that as read across from a load of other companies as well. And actually, they've been holding up okay in that. But actually, as part of that profit warning, you know, they did say as well, like, demand is tougher out there. There's not as much new business to go at the moment. A lot of their customers are sort of the big tech companies. So the environment has been tougher. This contract, you know, they absolutely didn't expect to lose. And part of the challenge is that because it came through that acquisition and you had an earnout on that, you've kind of paid a multiple for that deal. And then that acquisition hasn't lived up to that, let's say, because of this contract loss. But I think this is a really, really great company. And, you know, it was trading 6 times PE or something. You know, I do not think this is a 6 times PE business. So we've held on to our shares. I think actually it's given them an opportunity to look at the business, because it's a business which kind of, it's quite entrepreneurial in nature. So it does a lot of sort of smaller bolt-on acquisitions that are entrepreneurial led. And actually, you have to allow those people to, you know, those people who only want to sell their businesses into Next 15, where they believe that Next 15 is going to be the sort of best owner of their business going forward, and also allow them that independence to still grow. Whereas I think actually what they've done is they've said, look, this has given us a sort of clean sheet to look, and maybe we haven't got the optimum structure. So, you know, we are seeing them sort of consolidate a bit more within their sort of divisions in terms of how they can combine businesses together. But you have to be careful about that, because you can only do that when you get the opportunity and they fit, and you know, you don't put these entrepreneurs out of place. But I think there is, you know, there's often quite cross-selling opportunities as well between the different businesses. So it's tough. I think the problem is they need to, I don't think this is a 6 times PE business. So, you know, that's where I think this is a buy on a number of different time horizons. But I think you also need to see the environment get a bit better. You know, that would be helpful for them. They absolutely have levers to pull in terms of what they can do internally, but I think you need to see spend improving a bit as well.
Yeah, one thing I think certainly, I mean, I don't really follow it a great deal, but surprised me anyway, was just the customer concentration to lose, you know, effectively round about, I don't know, a sixth of your turnover just on one contract seemed quite excessive as a concentration perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that was a standout for them, and it came from this massive deal that they, this contract that they won, which you would have never turned down. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing contract. And to be fair, you know, it was a long-term contract. So, you know, if you look at the dominance of revenue and things, but you thought that this was a multi-year relationship. And it was part of a bigger thing as well, from what I understand. So, you know, it felt secure in that it felt like it was part of something big that there was a lot of investment and support going into. And for whatever reasons, you know, that no longer seems to be happening.
Yeah. Well, for every stock that goes down, you've got another one. But let's go and move to Trustpilot, which has just done, frankly, brilliantly over the last few years. It's certainly the UK's biggest per consumer review site, and helps companies collect data on consumer behavior and all this. How are you viewing this? It's not cheap, but... No. But frankly, the share price doesn't matter. It's just doing really well.
Yeah, and it's been really good, actually. We haven't owned this one for too long. We've probably owned it for about maybe 6 months.
Yeah.
We had owned it previously. And to be fair, you know, it had a good IPO and then a bad, you know, period. Yeah. It absolutely been showing up for its challenges. And what actually was quite good, when I reminded myself about this business, actually, when it had its tougher time, I sort of reminded myself that the business itself hadn't underperformed as much as I might have remembered. The share price had underperformed a lot.
Yeah.
you know, we went through a period where this is quite an early stage business in terms of profitability and growth, because they've got so much to go after. And we went through a period where, you know, their growth slowed a bit, but the market really then did not want to invest in this type of business. And that really suffered. So the big game changer for me, though, has been Zilla.
Yes.
Came in as chair.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think she's put a huge amount of investment, rigor and discipline into this business, because I think what we probably didn't realise is that when it was IPO'd, I think there was still a slight, you know, venture capital type mindset in there in terms of in the investment for growth, without really enough focus on why were you doing, you know, X investments? What was the return on that investment? What was the time frame? Was the business actually set up that if things went well, you know, you could drive proper earnings growth out of that? So she's been great at really improving that focus on investment, but the right type of investment. So we took a fresh eye on this stock again, and I felt really confident about actually, first its niche position. You know, it really is outstanding at what it does and has very few realistic competitors. And there's a huge scale benefit you get from this sort of business. So the more data that you gather, and the more embedded you become with your customers, you know, the more you get an opportunity to upsell and everything. So I think you've got that in the UK. You've got this real flywheel that I think can create really good, attractive growth, returns, margins in the UK. And then you've got these international growth opportunities, which they seem well placed to do. And I think they've got a sensible discipline as to how they approach that.
Yeah. This sort of share price and the valuation, to me, looks as though strategically it's very valuable to somebody, because it seems to me somebody's having a look at it, because it's 6x sales, 90x PE, etc. And I suspect that it's worth a lot more to somebody else than it is actually even on the market. But hey, yeah. I don't know. I mean, AI, generative AI, or whether it's some sort of trophy asset that somebody wants.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely is. It's niche in what it does. So I think that always means that you are potentially interesting to other parties. I mean, people get worried about when you talk about companies on sales multiples, and I get worried about it as well. I think on this one, you need to look at the earnings growth, because, you know, those PE multiples can seem high, and obviously it's done really well in the last few months. But you need to look at the operational leverage that you can have of that growth going forwards. And you know, if you look at platform businesses in the UK in the past, we've absolutely seen that. You know, the margins these things can generate if they can scale is great, particularly when you take that international as well. I think it's a really interesting asset. One thing I'd say, I think they can adopt things like AI in terms of, you know, operational efficiency and stuff. But one of the most important things about Trustpilot is actually the word trust, which is these companies only get, you know, they've only earned their place in the marketplace because actually people trust the data. And they do a huge amount of work in terms of making sure that data is clean, you know, removing fake reviews, all these things. And that is where, you know, I think quite hard to replicate this company, let's say, or for technology to replicate it, you know, the people element in there.
Yeah, I would agree. I say it looks like a trophy asset to me, unique, that is very valuable to somebody, but let's wait and see. Okay, let's come down the sort of like, well, maybe not actually, but let's move to Hollywood Bowl on the consumer side. Obviously, since people have come out of the pandemic, people have wanted to go bowling, and these guys have done very well. And also in the industry, I think about a year ago, 10 Entertainment got picked up from private equity. What's your view on Hollywood Bowl? They seem to be the biggest bowling alley provider in the UK, but expanding into to Canada.
Yeah, I think we talk about this as a consumer stock, don't you? But
yeah,
what's quite different is that this is something that people do once, maybe twice a year. You know, it's not a, I don't think in that way it's, we could talk about in a consumer stock like we're seeing retail and things. So when consumer spending has been tough, actually Hollywood Bowl still performed pretty well. This is another one that I'd highlight the management team. This management team are excellent. And they've really managed the business through all types of different environments. COVID was obviously pretty challenging for them.
Yeah.
But actually, so I think, look, we really like this business. It has good. I think it's done a lot in terms of investment in systems and CRM systems and things, understanding their customer. They get an amazing return on investment for new sites and for refurbishments and for some technology. So like pins on strings, for instance, is a thing. And what's the thing I like most about this business at the moment, probably? Well, it's two things. I think you've got a good balance of this, you know, resilient, reliable UK business, which doesn't have to operate in a growth market. Like bowling is not a big growth market. Mm. Actually, if you operate a business well, you can be a growth business within a dull market. And that's absolutely what they consistently do. But also now they have a Canadian opportunity. So we like companies who expand into adjacencies. And for them, this has been Canada. So they did a sort of low risk acquisition, let's say, in Canada. And that seems to be executing really well. And then, you know, they can play the consolidation angle there. So I think it's brought a whole new leg of growth to the business.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they probably.
I think they probably,
if they have a sort of like get a different sort of marketing spin on sort of 10-pin bowling, I mean, like paddle tennis, get it to be a sort of like a something that people really, really sort of like, you know, want to get involved in. It's on telly and, you know, it's one of these sort of like minority sports that suddenly becomes really popular. Then the whole place just goes, is heaving. But that's probably what they need.
I'm not hoping for that for this one. I think actually what they're very good at is they're very good at understanding who their customer base is and who they want it to be. So what we have seen in recent years in the UK is we've seen trampolining parks. We've seen all of these, what do you call them, like multi-arcade type things where you've got, you know, shuffleboards and, I don't know, skittles and all these things. And you've also, you have got more premium bowling. So for instance, these Lane 7, Polymer Bowl know what they are and what they want to be, and it's not any of those things. And actually, those businesses are generally much more driven by food and beverage spend than they are by the actual activity. Polymer Bowl wants to be, you know, the pleasurable place for all the family, for, you know, all types of different environments. And actually, what you need to try and do is sweat the assets, because and they do that through dynamic pricing. So because you have this fixed cost base, obviously there'll be certain peak periods that are always popular, but what they've been really good at as well is driving it across the day. The other good thing about them actually is their model in terms of the impact they've had from like National Living Wage or now the National Insurance Contributions is pretty limited versus some other sort of travel and leisure. You know, bits of hospitality that are tough on that. Hollywood Bowl's model mean that actually It's not helpful to their cost base, but it's something that I'm sure they can manage like they've managed before. And actually, they've never really had to push pricing that much.
They probably just need a different view from the marketing director. I mean, I wouldn't mind watching sort of Tuesday, Wednesday night, 9 o'clock, Champions League pins on strings. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Well, it's interesting. When they took the Canadian acquisition, league bowling was a big thing.
Yes, it is.
And actually, that's something that they've had to deal with actually in terms of when they've taken on those businesses, they've had to understand how to operate in that environment and how to sort of keep those customers happy. But also, you know, you're trying to run these businesses for the sort of maximum margin and return that you can generate. So it's something that's quite different in Canada than the UK.
Yeah, we've got three companies that people have asked us on the question. Okay. I don't think you own them though, Abby. But I'll just put up. Any thoughts would be very helpful. One of them is Robert Walters on the recruitment side. Another one is HVivo, which does challenge trials down in London for testing viruses. And the last one is a very small one. It's Transcend Technologies that does tire pressure and stuff. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on any of the three at all. I guess you probably haven't. But...
I can give some thoughts on Robert Walters.
Yes, please do. The recruitment agency. It's just the industry.
Industry, okay. So we don't currently own any of the recruitment stocks. We have owned Rob Walters. I think your challenge on the recruitment space at the moment is that I talked in the intro about markets you thought that would recover in 24 that haven't recovered.
Yes.
And recruitment is absolutely in one of those. And if I look at the outlook for 2025, have I seen that changing yet? No. So, I mean, Rob Walters absolutely believe in their proposition. They've put out some, they had a capital markets day, they put out some, you know, really attractive medium-term targets. I think the challenge is understanding why recruitment markets haven't come back, because what they will say is that the jobs are there. So they're actually, whereas you might think companies aren't recruiting, actually the sort of desire to recruit is reasonably high. But what they're seeing is that they're going through all the candidate process and then candidates are turning down offers at a much higher level than we ever saw historically. And it feels like, from what they say, a lot of it is about personal choice and affordability elements. So, you know, now a lot of these jobs are not 5 days in the office. So when people are actually weighing up the cost of sort of additional days and traveling elsewhere and things like that, and the maybe the work-life balance in terms of the comfort of, you know, they know what they've got at the moment, we just are not seeing candidates actually move jobs. That, you know, also the wage inflation, environment we went through is kind of past. So I don't know, 2 years ago there was a lot of chat from Rob Walters about, you know, people were getting 10% pay rises easily for moving job. Actually what was happening is companies were just bidding them up to keep them. But the differential in terms of the monetary difference for new jobs is more limited now in a lower sort of wage inflation environment. So the problem I see with Rob Waters is, and the whole recruitment space, is I just don't know when the dynamics that they're seeing at the moment are going to improve. Yeah. If and when they do, these stocks are very, very attractive because they're on low valuations. They generally have sort of kept a lot of their fixed cost base in terms of people. And if they start to drive, you know, top line growth again, the operational leverage is massive. But I just think it's one of those recoveries that's been pushed out and pushed out.
I think also maybe another factor is a lot of corporates, albeit they're not actually, you know, making huge amounts of redundancies, they're sort of like labor hoarding. They're equally not recruiting as many people at the moment in terms of hiring, largely probably because of the thought of how the business might change in a generative AI basis, because they don't know. So effectively, you've got a bit of a status quo. And corporates are not sacking people, but equally, they're not taking them on either.
No, and I think we've seen, I mean, other stocks I don't own, but for instance, FDM is having a tough time.
Yes.
We saw Alpha Financial Markets Consultant, which got acquired. You know, they were going through a tough time. All of their competitors had overhired through the sort of COVID period. And then, I think you're right. I think the people headcount type thing, you know, is a tough space.
Yeah. Okay, good. Right, I've got a really difficult question now for you, Abby. The sort of fine. What is your sort of out of all of them? What's your sort of your most excited? Which stock are you most excited about in heading into 2025? That you think another Trustpilot or another Hilton Foods or something like that that is going to hopefully set the pulse racing.
Yeah. So maybe a slightly different one in that something that's actually done really well, but I still think can do really well would be Morgan Sindall.
Oh, right. Okay. They're the contractors, aren't they?
And it's really, I mean, it's an incredibly well-managed business in their space. And, if you look at the history of how resilient these guys have been at meeting and beating expectations, it's just a standout. But why I'm still really confident about them is I think the fit-out business has really just continued to execute. And their biggest competitor, ISG, has just gone bust. So
I
give it the risk, though, that it can only, not the risk, sorry, the caveat that they I think they've got a lot of market share opportunity, but actually, you know, you can only take on so much work. I think that's another big opportunity for them next year. I mean, you look at that share price, it's fantastic.
That's the chart of the century, that is. It's hardly ever give back either.
Yeah, but I mean, have you got its PE on your list there?
I could find it.
It's still very attractively valued business. Not pricing a lot. So I think that one's really interesting. Another one which has been doing well already, but I think can continue, is Tatton Asset Management.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so really, a really great business. Outstanding management team. Plays in the MPS space.
Yeah.
But their asset growth that they've achieved, I think everyone's actually doing well in this space. So what people thought was a risk was that all the other big wealth managers and things would move into the MPS space.
Yeah.
But actually it's growing enough that they can all do all right. But Tatton were really early in this space and your investment performance is really good and they work with the network of IFAs. And, you know, I just think it's a business which, I mean, we were talking to them about sort of asset under management levels. And we're already talking about way bigger than we would have been talking about, you know, just a couple of years ago in terms of aspirations. So, yeah, I like that one.
Well, just on that one, what's their USP again? Because, I mean, obviously, most of the big asset managers have done quite, have struggled against the passives, but these guys have obviously managed to suck it in.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a low fee offering with great investment performance.
Right. Okay. Simple then.
Yeah. And a simple but clear and varied range of sort of portfolio offerings, and then working directly with the, you know, all these IFAs and things who want to use MPS now. You know, they don't want to be putting their own portfolios together.
What does MPS stand for again?
Managed Portfolio Service.
Oh, managed portfolio. Okay, yeah. Fine. Gotcha. So it's discretionary type of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. Okay. Well, that's fun. Yeah, cool. Have you got any others, or is that those two are fabulous?
I think those two are pretty good. Okay. I mean, I think I like Mortgage Advice Bureau. I think particularly in the second half of next year, because we can see remortgaging activity has to improve, basically. So even if you don't think housing, new build, or moving activity really picks up, you've got this remortgaging trend that comes through. But the caveat I said earlier is no one wants to touch a FCA CMA thing. Okay. And there is a sort of small FCA study. You know, it's not a review or anything, just in terms of income protection, which is a very small part of their business, and look at commissions there. So I just, you know, it feels like another little overhang. I think their underlying market is going to really improve for them in the second half of next year.
Brilliant. Okay, well, really appreciate all those, Abby, and your insights. Absolutely fabulous. And you may not have been too optimistic going into 2025, but you've made me optimistic anyway. So thanks for that. And very much looking forward to chatting again in about hopefully 6 months' time. So thanks, Abby.
Great. No, you're welcome. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand, and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards, so you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.